We are doing a study in the Minor Prophets, and so we are in the book of Haggai. If you have no idea where Haggai is, go to Matthew chapter 1 and back up about three small books, and you'll be in the right spot. Okay, Haggai chapter 2 is where we're going to be. Anybody remember on the timeline of the prophets, the book of Haggai, where does it fall? You know, before, during, or after the captivity? Where does the book of Haggai fall? Jim? After, okay? Haggai is the first of the post-captivity prophets, okay? Now, we will go through a review, Lord willing, here in a little bit, but we're talking about after. So, God sent prophets to warn them. Israel continued in their idolatry. They went into captivity. About 125 years later, Judah followed them into captivity. And now they have been allowed to return, at least some of them have. And they had returned, that was around 535 when they were allowed to return. And the time of Haggai is about 13 years later, around 522 BC. So they returned, they'd gotten started, they'd gotten discouraged, and then they got sidetracked. And then when they tried to get started again, there was opposition, and they got a government edict saying, you have to stop. Well, now that government edict has been reversed by Darius, or Darius, depending on who's pronouncing it, and they've been allowed to restart. So Haggai is preaching to the people primarily about getting back to the work of God and the work of God's house. Okay? So we left off last time in chapter 2. We looked at verses 7 through 9. Let's look at that again, and we'll pick up again in verse 10. Verse 7 through 9, I will shake all nations, and the desire of all nations shall come. And I will fill this house with glory, saith the Lord of hosts. The silver is mine, and the gold is mine, saith the Lord of hosts. Now, verse 6 and 7 talks about shaking the heavens, the earth, the sea, and the dry land. That can be literal, and that can be metaphorical. And I think at times, you know, it refers to both. But I think here, shaking heaven and earth, this is a reference, I think, to shaking up the world order. You remember when the wise men showed up and asked Herod, where is he that is born king of the Jews? Was Herod shaken up? Did that upset his apple cart? Yes, it did. It turned his world upside down. What did he in turn do? He murdered all the babies when he couldn't find the specific one he was looking for. And it did Jesus's teaching and his practices, did that shake, if I could say it that way, did that shake up the Pharisees, the Sadducees, the religious order of the day? Absolutely. Okay? So, you know, literally when Jesus returns in the second coming, when he touches the earth, the earth will shake, there'll be earthquakes and all those kinds of things. But here, I think this right here in verse 7, I will shake all nations, has a little bit more of that kind of emphasis. Now, verse 8, the silver is mine, the gold is mine, saith the Lord. Why does that matter? Well, do you remember in verse 3 where he said, who's left among you that saw the former house? What was part of the magnificence of Solomon's temple? The silver and the gold and all of that. If you go back to 1 Chronicles, you look at how much David had set aside for the temple. I've done the calculations before. And if you take the gold and silver that David had set aside for the temple, it's over $1 billion with a B in today's dollars. Probably more than $2 billion now. And he told Solomon, hey, I've set aside this and you could add to it. So it was magnificent. And they were discouraged partly because they're looking at it going, wow, this is going to be nothing like Solomon's temple. What did God say in verse 8? The silver is mine and the gold is mine. Was God discouraged that they didn't have as much silver and gold in this house? No. Verse 9, the glory of this latter house shall be greater than the former, saith the Lord of hosts, and in this place will I give peace, saith the Lord of hosts. Why would the glory of this house be greater than Solomon's? Because it was in this house that Jesus would personally walk. Jesus, the Messiah himself, would walk in this very house that they were beginning to rebuild. The foundation's been laid at this point. The wall, you know, they don't have walls up and that kind of thing yet. But in this very house, Jesus himself would walk, which is why the glory of this house would be greater than Solomon's temple. Now, this is the one that would be built, that would be there for a few hundred years. Jesus would walk there, and about 30 years after Jesus, Titus and Rome would come in and level Jerusalem, level the temple, and it's all gone. There's a third temple that's talked about in Ezekiel and some of the other prophets. There's a third temple that'll be rebuilt in the millennium. Okay? But this right here is speaking of the second temple, sometimes called Zerubbabel's temple. Why Zerubbabel? Just to make it hard to say. No, because Zerubbabel was the man who led the first return. Okay? Too early in the morning for all of these names and dates. Yeah, I got it. But when they were allowed to return from Babylon, it happened in three separate trips, three phases. Okay? The first phase was Zerubbabel and a bunch of the priests and leaders, and they went back, and that's the group we're talking about now. Phases two and three happened 70, 75 years later, and that was people were more familiar with, Ezra and Nehemiah. Okay? But if you remember, when Nehemiah went back, his goal was to build what? The walls. Okay? When the enemies threatened Nehemiah, some of them tried to get him to hide where? Go in the temple and hide. See, the temple was finished by the time Nehemiah got back. All right? That's the dots we're trying to connect here. Okay? So at this point in time, the foundation's laid, and Haggai and Zechariah are preaching to them about getting back to the business of finishing God's house. Okay? By the time Ezra and Nehemiah show up, the temple had been finished, but the walls of Jerusalem hadn't been rebuilt. And that was Nehemiah's primary focus, was rebuilding the walls. All right? So that leads us then to the final section. All right? Chapter 2, verses 10 through 19. True holiness and God's blessing. Remember we said Haggai is four short messages. We've looked at three. Here's the final one, verses 10 through 19. In the 24th day of the ninth month, in the second year of Darius, came the word of the Lord by Haggai the prophet, saying. Now, when did Haggai's first message come? Look at chapter 1, verse 1. Second year of Darius, what month? Ben? Jared? 6 months. Okay? So, second year of Darius, 6 months was the first message. This is the last one, second year of Darius and what? Ninth month. So all that we know about Haggai's ministry was like 3 months. That's all we know. That's not to say that he didn't do other things for the Lord, but that's all that we have recorded. Okay? It's a very brief window of time. The 24th day of the ninth month, second year of Darius, came the word of the Lord by Haggai the prophet, saying, thus saith the Lord of hosts, ask now the priests concerning the law, right? So, what we're going to see here is that defiled living prevents God's blessings. Now, most of you are going to say, duh. But, do we need reminders on that from time to time? Sure we do. Now, in verse 11, he says, ask the priests. Okay? Why ask the priests? Who was supposed to know the law of God better than anybody and teach it? The priests and the Levites. That was their job. You know, part of the reason that God took the priests and Levites and scattered them out among the tribes is that, in essence, they were to be the salt. They were to teach the Word of God and help to preserve the nation of Israel. Okay? But the priests and the Levites were the ones that were supposed to teach. So God says, all right, go ask the ones that are supposed to know concerning the law. So this is a, if we could say it this way, a technical question. So when you read verses 12 and 13, if you go, I don't know what that means, it's okay. I mean, this is going back to Exodus and Leviticus and specific instructions. All right, verse 12. If one bear holy flesh in the skirt of his garment, and with his skirt do touch bread or pottage or wine or oil any meat, shall it be holy? And the priest answered and said, no. All right, so the first, we have the illustrations here. You have the holy flesh. If a priest in the skirt of his garment, now remember they had a white linen robe, so if he's using that kind of like you'd use an apron and he's carrying the holy flesh, meaning that which has been dedicated to the Lord, that's the part of the sacrifice that belonged to God or maybe part that belongs to the priest. If he's carrying that here and he bumps the oil jar or he touches something else, is the meat still holy? Yes. Okay? It's still, ceremonially, it's still good. But does that touching these other things make them clean? All right, just for illustration, if I'm going to use my pen, I'm going to say this represents that which is holy. If this is that which is holy and it touches this or this or this, does that sanctify these items? No. It only is sanctifying itself, right? There's an illustration here, but you got to understand the main point before you understand the application, right? So if holy flesh touches these other things, are the other things made holy? No. Verse 13. Then said Haggai, if one that is unclean by a dead body touch any of these, shall it be unclean? And the priest answered and said, yes, it'll be unclean. So now, let's use different. Okay, I'll use my keys here. This is going to represent that which is unclean. All right, so if this is unclean and it touches one of these other things, are these now considered unclean? Yes. Okay. Now, there's an application. He said, does having something that is holy automatically make everything else sanctified? No. Does having something that it is dirty defile other things around it? Yes. Now, look at the application. Verse 14. Then answered Haggai and said, so is this people, and so is the nation before me. That is Hebrew poetic expression. The people and the nation, that's not two groups. That's two ways of describing the same people. So is this people, and so is this nation before me, saith the Lord. And so is every work of their hands. And that which they offer there is unclean. All right, so what's he saying? He's saying that they were living in a way that God was not the center of their life. They were not following everything, but it appears that they were offering sacrifices. You remember last week, those of you that were here, we talked about the fact that one of Haggai's messages was delivered on the occasion of the Feast of Tabernacles. So it seems like they were observing some of the feasts and offering some of the sacrifices, but here's the point of this illustration. What he's saying is you can't just offer a sacrifice on Passover, offer a sacrifice on, you know, Pentecost, and then New Moon and Day of Atonement. You can't just do that, live the way you want to the rest of the year and expect that everything else is clean. So these few sacrifices by themselves don't touch everything else and make them clean. However, if you live in a way that's unclean before the Lord, everything is defiled. Okay? So, in essence, what he's saying is you can't just... Can I make a modern-day application? I understand that Israel's not the church. Okay, but if I'm going to make a modern-day application, I'm going to say what he's saying is this. You can't just show up to church for a couple hours a week, live like you want to the rest of the week, and expect God to bless your life because you showed up to church. That's the modern-day application. Okay, or if we take it a step further, well, I read my Bible pretty much every day. I don't do anything that I read, but I read my Bible every day, so therefore God's going to bless my life. Or I put a $1,000 seed gift on my Visa so God will pay it off. You understand what I'm saying? You can't just do an act, a religious act, or do, you know, religious things on a consistent basis, live the way you want to any other time, and expect that God's going to bless every aspect of their life. Now remember, what had we talked about in the previous chapter, how they had gone and looked for much, and there was little. There was, look back in chapter 1, verse number 9. Haggai chapter 1, verse number 9. You looked for much and came to little. When you brought it home, I did blow upon it, scatter it. Okay? Remember, this was descriptions of God's chastening. They were saying, well, you know, we're offering sacrifices, and we're back here in the land, so God should be blessing everything. And Haggai and the word of the Lord are saying, no. Those outward things are to be an expression of what's going on in your heart. You love God, you want to please Him, you want to do right before God, and the outgrowth of that is, I want to offer the sacrifices, I want to attend the worship services, I want to do these things. Okay? So you can't say, well, you know, I have a family Bible on my coffee table, or, you know, we go to church pretty much every week, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. All the things that you would typically hear if you listen and talk to people or ask them, you know, about their religious life. You can't just do those things and go through those motions without the heart also being right with God and expect God to bless. All right? Now, if you're listening, most of you are thinking, well, yeah. But it's easy to get in that mode sometimes, isn't it? Especially when life gets busy. Life gets busy and there's pressure and it's like, okay, well, I'm doing the things, I have the punch list. We've got to remember, it's not just the punch list. It's a heart that loves God. And I'm doing the punch list for reasons that are pleasing to God. Okay, so what's being said here in, by way of illustration is you can't just offer a sacrifice and expect that to sanctify everything else. If you're living as though you're unclean, you've touched a dead body, then God's not going to bless the rest of it. You've got to get everything in line in a way that's pleasing God. Verse 15, and now I pray you consider from this day and upward. Verse 18, consider now from this day and upward. All right, this expression here, consider, is the same phrase that we looked at in chapter 1, verse 5, consider your ways. Chapter 1, verse 7, consider your ways. Here in chapter 2, verses 15 and 18, you have the same phrase, consider. Remember we said what it means. It means to put to heart or to take it to heart. Okay, so early on, God said, I want you to evaluate, consider your ways. Everything that you've done hasn't brought the blessings that you were looking for. Maybe you need to evaluate. Now here at the end, as Haggai is wrapping up, he says it again. You need to take it to heart. Consider where you are. Verse 15 again. Now I pray you consider from this day and upward, from before a stone was laid upon a stone in the temple of the Lord, since those days were when one came to a heap of 20 measures and there were but 10, when one came to the press fat to draw out 50 vessels out of the press and there were but 20. What is that describing? A time of plenty or a time of famine, dearth? Is that a time when you can just pull up to the pump and fill up your vehicle? Or is that a time when you can pull up and there's a $20 or $30 limit on the pump? Okay. Is that a time when you can just, you know, get whatever you want? Or you got to go to five stores to find paper products? All right, I'm trying to use that as what God is saying here is that they wanted a certain amount and half of it was available. Okay, this is again part of that consider your ways. Look, this is what you need. You don't have enough to meet the needs. Verse 17, God's still speaking through the prophet. I smote you with blasting, with mildew, with hail. All right, if you are primarily a farmer, that's how you make your living, that's how you survive. Blasting, mildew, and hail, are those good or bad for crops? Yeah, even if you're not a farmer, you can figure that out. Okay, that's not going to help your garden. That's not going to help, whether it's a cash crop or whether that's what you're going to eat for the coming year. The blasting, which would be, you know, a disease or plague, the mildew, the hail, it's not going to help. God says, here's why I have chastened you. I smote you with blasting, mildew, and hail, and all the labors of your hand. For what purpose? To get their attention. Look at the end of verse 17. Yet ye turn not to me, saith the Lord. Is God mean and vindictive? Does God do things because he enjoys tormenting? I mean, God is not like little boys that would, you know, pull the wings off of butterflies or pull the legs off of ants just to watch it squirm. Yeah. All the dads are trying not to smile right now, and all the ladies are going, yes, those things happen. I have seen it done. Okay, God is not the kind that it just torments for the enjoyment of it. If God does things that on our end are painful or unpleasant, is it because he does not enjoy that? Or he enjoys tormenting us? What's the purpose? Hebrews says, no chastening for the present seems joyous but grievous, but afterwards it yields what? Fruit, peaceable fruit of righteousness. God always does it for a purpose. If God does these things, it's for a purpose, and it's usually to get our attention and to get us back to where we need to be. Okay? It says, yet ye turn not to me, saith the Lord. He said, I tried and tried and tried to get your attention. Now I'm going to send you a prophet and try to get your attention one more time. Again in verse 18, consider now, from this day and upward, from the 24th day of the ninth month, even from the day that the foundation of the Lord's temple was laid, consider it. So, he's dating it here. All right, this is the day that the foundation is laid. You pay attention. You make a note. Take it to heart. All right, verse 19, is the seed yet in the barn? Yea, as yet the vine and the fig tree and the pomegranate, the olive tree hath not brought forth, from this day I will bless you. Is the seed yet in the barn? In other words, is the harvest in and is next year's seed laid up? Do you have the fruits laid up? No, you've been short, but God says, I'm going to bless you. And then here's the fourth and final message here in verses 20 to 23. Again came the word of the Lord unto Haggai on the 24th day of the month, same day, saying, speak to Zerubbabel, governor of Judah, saying, I will shake the heavens and the earth, and I will overthrow the throne of kingdoms, and I will destroy the strength of kingdoms of the heathen. I will overthrow the chariots and those that ride in them. The horses and their riders shall come down, every one by the sword of his brother. Now, you might look at that and say, oh, okay, I know when that was going to happen. Maybe. Verse 23, in that day, saith the Lord of hosts, I will take thee, O Zerubbabel, my servant, the son of Shealtiel, saith the Lord, and will make thee as a signet, for I have chosen thee, saith the Lord of hosts. Okay, who is the specific object of this message here in verses 20 to 23? Zerubbabel. Okay? It's Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel. Right? That's the man that was the leader of this first return. Okay? So the first and primary application here is to Zerubbabel. Why is God telling Zerubbabel that he's going to overthrow kingdoms and take down the heathen and protect him? Why did Zerubbabel think he needed protection? Historically, what's the context? Israel has been where? Or Jerusalem, Judah, they've been where for the previous 70 years? Captivity in Babylon. Now they're back, but they are just simply captives returned to take land that other people had taken possession of in the meantime, right? So they're there to kick out the homesteaders, if I could say it that way. The squatters, yes? Okay? They're there to kick people out. Are the people that are around them happy to see them? Now, if you remember, the Assyrians took and mixed people. They transplanted them. So then you have the people that came to be known as the Samaritans. Were the Samaritans, the mixed people, were they happy to see the Jews rebuilding the temple? No. So did they have peaceful relationships with their neighbors? Not really. Were the people around them happy to see their church going up? Hey, you want to have a barn raising? You want to have a temple raising? We'll come help you with a work day. No, it was the opposite of that. Why did Zerubbabel feel like he needed protection? Because he did. He lived amongst enemies. That sounds a lot like Israel today, doesn't it? You know, nobody in their immediate area is really happy for their prosperity. I mean, the stated goal of many of the Muslim nations is to push Israel into the sea, meaning they will come from the east towards the west and push them into the Mediterranean. It's their stated goal. What I'm saying is some things never change. Okay. But why did Zerubbabel need protection? Because not many people around them were real happy with what they were doing. Have you ever been in a situation where you're trying to do something for the Lord and you're like, whew, this is not working out like I thought it would? Or, Lord, I think I'm doing exactly what you want me to do, but man, it looks like I'm getting ready to get eaten up. Sure. Whether that's true or not, we felt that way. Feels like things are crumbling around you. And God knew exactly what Zerubbabel needed. Remember, we talked about in Haggai that the first message was addressed to Zerubbabel as a civic leader and to the high priest, Joshua, as the religious leader, directing them and encouraging them. Well, here God gives, again, Zerubbabel, the governor, exactly what he needed. He says, look, I'm going to overthrow kingdoms and take care of you. Verse 23, in that day, saith the Lord of hosts, I will take thee, O Zerubbabel, my servant, the son of Shealtiel, saith the Lord, and make thee as a signet. What is the signet? You know, that was the ring that the king would use as a seal. I mean, where was that kept? Was that kept in the barn with the plow instruments? No. I mean, it was kept, you know, on his right hand or right near him in a place of protection. Okay, so as a signet, in other words, I'm going to keep you close by. I'm going to keep you. This same type of expression is used in Song of Solomon as in more of a romantic context. Set me as a seal on my heart. You know, but the idea of the signet ring was that it was going to be close by. It was going to be at God's hand. It was going to be in a place of protection, not in an outlying place somewhere. It was a chosen place. I've set thee as a signet. I have chosen thee, saith the Lord of hosts. So what's the promise here? Zerubbabel, you do what's right. You have a heart that's right with me. You try to lead God's people in that which is right. I'm going to protect you. I'm going to take care of you. I'm going to provide for you. Now, do we have any similar promises from the Lord? God made any promises to us like that? Maybe like, you know, I will never leave thee nor forsake thee. Maybe like, my God shall supply all your need according to his riches and glory by Christ Jesus. Can you add to that list? I'm just trying to get you started. You probably could. Yeah. But here, God's the last message of Haggai was just simply directed to Zerubbabel as the governor. In other words, everything around him was chaos and destruction. And God said, I can take care of it. I can take care of you when everything around you is chaos. Zerubbabel needed that, and I'm glad. You know why? Because I need it too. I'm just glad my name's not on it. You can look at Zerubbabel and say, yeah, he needed the reassurance. Well, guess what? We all do. We all do. I mean, we can look at Joshua, and where God says, be strong and of a good courage, and say, well, yeah, Joshua needed it. Guess what? So do we. And we can look at Peter and say, yep, Jesus said, you know, I'm telling you this so that your faith doesn't fail when you're strengthening your brother. I can look at him and say, I'm glad Peter's name's not mine, but yeah, I'm the same way sometimes. But here, God, through Zerubbabel, two different guys, very different time frames. Zerubbabel, I'm going to take care of you. I'm going to protect you. You do the work of God, I'm going to see that you're protected. How did Zerubbabel respond? We're not told. Did God ever tell Zerubbabel that again? We're not told here in the book of Haggai. But from at the beginning, Haggai addresses Zerubbabel and Joshua, the civic leader and the religious leader. And then here at the end, he addresses Zerubbabel again. Why? Because he was going to have to, as the leader, set a tone, set a direction, and he was going to be the target of the opposition. So God sent him a promise, exactly what he needed at that time. So you have Haggai prophesying, and the specific focus of Haggai is what building? The temple, the house of God. Remember, we gave you this quote last week, but I'll give it to you again if I can find it quickly on my notes here. And if I can't, I'll paraphrase it. Basically, the idea is this. Other people or other people groups could exist without a house of worship, but Israel could not. Because Israel's entire existence as a nation was based around their relationship with God. And as such, the house of God was central to Israel's existence as a nation, which is why this focus on the house of God was not just a building project, but rather it was central to their restored worship and their restored relationship with God. So Haggai's entire focus is on the house of God. Now, if you look across the page from Haggai chapter 2, what book do you see there? Zechariah. Look at Zechariah 1 and verse 1. In the eighth month, in the second year of Darius. Now, if you're paying attention to the dates, what do you see? Yeah, these guys are more co-workers, so to speak. They ministered at the same time. So we start in the sixth month, second year of Darius in Haggai 1. Zechariah 1 is the eighth month. Haggai's final message in chapter 2 is in the ninth month. But in other words, Haggai and Zechariah. Now we mentioned that in the introduction. If you go back to Ezra chapter 4, it's mentioned that under the preaching of Haggai and Zechariah, the house of God, that the building that had been stalled was restarted. And though they helped motivate to get this done. But what you see here with Zechariah is that there's an overlap. So these guys were both shooting at the same target. Okay? They're both driving at the same point to their co-workers. All right? So that brings us to the book of Zechariah. So, real quick review. Why? Because none of us remember it the first three or four times we see it. As far as the captivity of Israel goes, Assyria captured the north in 722. And then they transplanted people, repopulated. All right? Assyria was followed by Babylon. Babylon conquered Assyria around 612. And then in 605, Nebuchadnezzar came down and conquered Jerusalem. Now, they did that in three phases. They tried to let them stay there if they would be good boys and girls. They weren't. They continued to rebel. And so eventually, in 586, he came and destroyed the temple, the walls of Jerusalem, everything, knocked it all down. So you have Assyria, and then you have Babylon. Well, Babylon was followed by the Medes and the Persians. We read about that in the book of Daniel, right? The handwriting on the wall, God's numbered your days and finished it. And then, you know, the Medes and the Persians conquered Babylon. Well, as soon as that transition happened, then Cyrus, who was a Mede, said, all right, I'm going to let the Jews go back. So you have Assyria, the northern part of Israel's in captivity. Then Babylon takes that over and they conquer Judah and Jerusalem. Well, then the Medes and the Persians come in and they had a different mindset. They allowed some to return, okay? And then in 520, when that was challenged, Darius confirms the decree of Cyrus. Cyrus said, you can go back. And so Zerubbabel and some of them went back. Well, they got started and then they stalled out. When they tried to get started again, some of the Samaritans that were around them said, hey, we don't like this. And they sent a malicious letter to the government, lied about them, and got the work stopped. Well, then eventually, Darius confirmed that decree of Cyrus. And then that's why Haggai and Zechariah, it's the second year of Darius. I've got my dates just slightly off on that, but that's the general timeline. Xerxes, in some of the history books, is Ahasuerus in the book of Esther, and Artaxerxes, okay? It was under Artaxerxes II that you had Ezra and Nehemiah. So, under the Medes and the Persians. Of course, they were followed by the Greek Empire and Alexander the Great, and then eventually the Roman Empire in the time of Christ. But that's the, you know, world history, that's the big picture overview. Right, the prophets that we've already covered, Obadiah, Joel, Jonah, Amos, Hosea, Micah, those are all before the north went into captivity. All right, around the time that the northern tribes went into captivity to Assyria, you had Nahum, Zephaniah, of course, Jeremiah as well, but you have these during that period in between the north and the south captivity. All right, then in the Babylonian captivity, again, you had Jeremiah, Habakkuk, Daniel, and Ezekiel. Okay? Remember, Habakkuk was just prior to it saying this is what's going to happen. All right? So now, in the post-captivity prophets, we've looked at Haggai, and Haggai and Zechariah are in the same timeline. So, when we're coming down to it, Zechariah and Malachi are the only ones we have left. So, but when you're looking at the overview, the timeline, this is where we are. Okay, trying to go back and correlate where the prophets were to world history and Israel's history. All right, so that puts us right here with the book of Haggai. Remember the timeline, Haggai and Zechariah. You have 586 was the destruction of the temple. 539, Babylon falls to Cyrus the Great. 538, Cyrus makes a decree letting them return. Sheshbazzar was his Persian name. Sheshbazzar and Zerubbabel are the same guy. One's a Persian name, one's a Jewish name. All right. 535, they started laying the foundation. And then, you know, in 522 is when we get the opposition. And then around 520, the temple was resumed under Haggai and Zechariah. Okay. Later on, like 70 years later, you get Ezra and Nehemiah. All right. Now, in Zechariah, in Zechariah 1, verse 1, everybody got the timeline? Got that memorized? There'll be a quiz next week to open Sunday school. So, well, hopefully if we repeat it enough times, at least some of the major points will stick here, okay? But Zechariah, the time here is the 8th month, 2nd year of Darius. So we have the overlap. Chapter 1, verse 1, in the 8th month, 2nd year of Darius, came the word of the Lord unto Zechariah, the son of Berechiah, the son of Iddo, the prophet, saying... Okay, so who was Zechariah's father? Berechiah. Who was Iddo then? Grandpa. Right, that's what that means. The son of the son of the son of. It's going back generations. All right, that's important because when we look at Iddo, Berechiah is not mentioned a whole lot. And it's quite possible that he died as a younger adult man. But Iddo is mentioned in the book of Nehemiah, okay? So, you have the time here, and then you have the man Zechariah. His name, all right? Jim, what does Zakar mean? Do you remember? Put him on the spot. See, he's been doing other things like candidating at a church, not studying Hebrew vocab. Okay? Zakar means to remember. Like, where did we park? What? The way I remember it is, where did we park Zakar? You know, that's how I remember it. So, but Zakar, and you can almost see that the name Zachariah, the first part of his name is like a transliteration of the word Zakar, which means to remember. And then the Ah on the end of that is the short form of Yah. Yahweh or Jehovah is the short form. So you put those two pieces together, to remember and Yah or the Lord, what do you think the name Zachariah means? Remember God, or the Lord remembers. And I think it would probably be in the... But yes, God remembers. The Lord remembers. Okay? So, why is that significant in the time that he ministered? Because God had remembered them. He brought them out of captivity. Now, this is not the only person in the Old Testament with the name of Zechariah. In fact, there's over a dozen. Okay? Maybe almost two dozen. There's a lot of different Zecharias, but it's interesting in this context that this was his name. Okay, but he's the son of Berechiah, the son of Iddo. That's his background. Okay, so when we talk about his family and his position, let's look back for just a second at Nehemiah chapter 12. Can you do that? Hold your place here in Zechariah and turn back and look at Nehemiah chapter 12. Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, Nehemiah. Okay, if you don't know where Nehemiah is, it's right before Ezra. Right after Ezra. You're not listening anyway. All right, Nehemiah chapter 12, verse 1. Now these are the priests and the Levites that went up with Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel. Have we heard that name before? Yes. All right, this is the first return led by Zerubbabel. And in Nehemiah 12 here, this is the list of the names of those that went with him. All right, look at verse 4. Iddo, Ginnetho, Abijah. Okay, verse 8, moreover the Levites, Jeshua, Benua, Kadmiel, Sherebiah, Judah, Mattaniah. All right, but the one I want you to see in particular in verse number 4 is Iddo. Okay, this Iddo, or Iddo here, is the same one that we see in Zechariah chapter 1. Now he's listed with who? Nehemiah chapter 12 verse 1 says all these names here are who? Priests and Levites. So what is Zechariah's descent? His grandfather was a priest. What do you think is his position? He's a priest. So just like Jeremiah and Ezekiel, Zechariah is both priest and prophet. Okay? So he was a Levite, he was a priest, he was of that family, but then he was also given a special ministry as a prophet on top of that. Okay? So, we're not out of material, but we are out of time. I at least wanted to tie those two together with Haggai and Zechariah and the timelines and all that, and we'll look in the weeks to come on their message.